Court. My name is Franklin Gimbel, and I am here this morning to discuss this case from the perspective of Stephen Foti, my client. But as Mr. Olson indicated, we have had a conference, that is, the four lawyers who are involved in this case. And with your leave this morning, it is my intention, with prearrangement with the Court, to speak for 10 minutes up front of our 30 minutes on the questions of notice and spill into vagueness. Mr. Meyer will follow me. Mr. Morgan will follow him for 5 minutes. Mr. Meyer, 10 minutes. And I will pick up the rebuttal at 5 minutes.
But have you divided up the subjects? What would Mr. Meyer
have? Yeah. I'm talking on notice. And I may spill into vagueness.
Okay.
Mr. Meyer will step in on the standards, which also deals with the vagueness and spill into the question of separation of powers. And Mr. Morgan will be the cleanup to talk about his client, the non-public official's reason to be someplace other than in this litigation.
Okay. Now, my question is, are the same issues raised in this? You've been here for the oral argument.
I'm yes,
sure you've read the Qualla briefs.
Correct.
Same issues raised in both cases?
For all intents and purposes, they are, yes.
Can you have inconsistent decisions?
No. With that leave, I would tell Your Honors that our clients are not here today asking this Court to provide politicians who serve in the legislative branch of government with a license to run their political campaigns out of their office. What we do seek from you here is recognition that neither a prosecuting attorney, a member of the executive branch of government, or a trial judge should be able to build a bridge between a cobbled together expression of public policy and the reception center at Dodge Correctional Center in Waupun, Wisconsin. And it is our position that that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did in this case. They essentially said that there is, within a set of prohibitory statements of public policy in an ethics code, in the rules of behavior of the State Assembly, in emails that were circulated by officials of the State Assembly and by circulars that were circulated by the State Assembly, in concert with, as the Chief has indicated, this list of prohibitory statutes that bring about in violation thereof the consequences of forfeiture or misdemeanor sanctions, they have built a bridge to the reception center at Dodge Correctional and made the behavior of our clients in these two cases tantamount to a felony. That was done by legislation coming from the executive, not from the state senate or the state assembly. And in particular, my client, if I could take the liberty, viewing his behavior through the eyes of a criminal defense lawyer. Now, I've been a lawyer for just short of 45 years, 5 years as a federal prosecutor, maybe 35 of those years as a criminal defense lawyer. If a client walks into my office with a problem that may land him in a criminal court, the first thing that I do in trying to analyze his or her prospects is I look at the statute. The second thing that I do in order to analyze his or her prospects is to look at the jury instruction interpreting his or her prospects. In this case, if Mr. Foti had come to see me and had said, am I in trouble subjecting myself to behavior that might land me in the state prison system for my behavior that's been articulated in the criminal complaint, I could not have answered his question yes, because I would not have gone to emails, I would not have gone to circulars, I would not have gone to a code of ethics, I would not have gone to this list of forfeiture offenses and misdemeanor offenses and said that you have to be aware of the fact that the prosecutor is at liberty under this statute to impose upon you a duty that the legislature has not otherwise defined, and make that duty the threshold over which, if you cross it, you subject yourself to felony sanctions.
Mr. Gimbel, Will you draw the line for me between fair notice and due process and vagueness, or do you think they all overlap or they're one and the same thing?
I think it would be as hard for me to draw clear, bright lines in those three areas, Justice Crooks, as it would be for me here to tell you how it was that in their wisdom the Court of Appeals said that they could tell the difference between political activity and legislative activity. Those are concepts, if you will, not easily definable terms. Notice and vagueness run together. And I don't know that you can bright line what the difference is between them. I only know that if I'm going to step in before a judge in a criminal case as a defense lawyer, the first thing that I am going to do on behalf of my client is to say that my client's behavior wasn't identified as criminal misbehavior prior to the time that he engaged in that conduct. That's what happened here. That conduct was not identified as criminal misbehavior by the legislature. Mr. Blanchard has identified it as criminal misbehavior. Ms. Oswald has identified it as criminal misbehavior. And the Court of Appeals bought into their argument by essentially creating a collage of rules, regulations, emails, bulletins, and ethical scripture to say that that is duties. When I heard Ms. Oswald tell this court this morning that the trial judge in a trial of any one of these cases could put before the jury as a list of duties all of the prohibitions of Chapter 11, I was aghast. Because how would the jury be able to decide unanimously which, if any, of those things, if they were listed in the jury's instruction in the case, were the duty, although not called duties by that legislative enactment, was the one that any one or all of the people accused in this case actually trespassed against.
Counselor, I'd like you to look at 19.45 sub 5, which the state has argued forms the basis for a duty. And that statute's found in a chapter which is called General Duties of Public Officials.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you're going to end up with a misdemeanor according to the chapter for a violation of sub 5, but why can't we ascribe it a duty, setting that one problem aside?
Because I don't think that that is other than a code of ethics, and I think it starts out as a code of ethics, and it creates essentially in terms that I don't think were contemplated by 946.12 subsection 3, what that duty is that puts the person in harm's way with respect to criminal consequences. There are no criminal consequences that flow from that prescription.
Yeah, it does. In 19.58, it makes it a misdemeanor to violate 1945 sub 5, much as 11.61 makes the violation 11.36 a misdemeanor. Okay?
Yes.
So that's a problem for me, obviously, but my question goes more to you about where's the identification of a duty, and it's the duty thing, and I'm wondering why you can't say that's a duty if the chapter says general duties of public officials.
Well, I don't have that statute right in front of me, and I don't have the time to go look for it, but I'm going to maintain a consistent position, and my consistent position is that the Court of Appeals itself, in its own language, essentially said that in this case, the assortment, and these are their words, the assortment of sources, and they're talking about sources from which they can draw out what is the definable duty that in the one count that my client was charged with and the other counts that others of the people accused in this case were accused of having violated to get to this felony misconduct, includes applicable statutes, legislative rules and guidelines, and the Assembly Employee Handbook. They thereafter went on to say, and additionally includes emails, memo from the Chief Assembly Clerk, Ethics Board and Ethics Board advisory opinion in 1978, and came to the conclusion that duty is, this is their words, not mine, the duty is not to do something affirmative, but the duty is to refrain, and I'm quoting from their opinion, to refrain from directing state employees to manage political campaigns and to engage in political activities. They went on to say that it is unambiguous that those are essentially an appropriate notice to our clients. And I go back to my seat behind the desk in my office acting as a criminal defense lawyer, and I don't think that it's reasonable under the strictures of due process to impose upon citizens an obligation to search for, as the Court of Appeals suggests, our clients must, those things that might be within a definition of the duties that were contemplated in the 1950s when the misconduct in office statute was
What are the duties of a legislator? Where am I going to find the duties of a legislator?
You won't. They're not in the statute book.
So
you can cobble them together, as the Court of Appeals attempted to do.
So a legislator can never violate the statute, then?
I don't think that's correct. I was a defense lawyer, believe it or not, in the Tronca case. I mean, that kind of shows some of my age. I don't have gray hair anymore, but I can say I represented an 80-year-old guy by the name of Charles Wolfe, and he was the bag man. And he was the guy who picked up the money from the Chinese restaurant owner and took it to Tronca, who took it to Ryan. And in that case, while this court dealt with that case from the point of view of discretionary powers, there's no question but in that case, there was another violation of the law. What Mr. Ryan attempted to defend himself on was he attempted to say, I was not on the Utilities and Licensing Committee of the city, and therefore I really didn't vote on whether this license should go through or not. But in that hearing, he was the local alderman, and the committee said, Mr. Ryan, what's your position? If the people paid the money, he said, I'm in favor of it. If they didn't pay the money, he was against it. That was prosecutable under the
line.
I think the word inherent duties is okay. I think it's okay. But in this case, that's not what the Court of Appeals said. They said what we're doing is we're buying into the legislation that's been advanced here by the prosecutor, because the prosecutor is articulating duties by having essentially this melange or collage of different sources, and the Court of Appeals accepts that as multiple sources from which to articulate notice. And I think my 10 minutes are up.
Chief, may I ask a question?
The
Court of Appeals in paragraph 17 of their opinion says, the defendants cite no authority for the proposition that we are restricted to an exclusive statute or one exclusive source to ascertain his or her duty. And I hear part of your argument being, hey, notice, vagueness, where can we go to find the duty? But in response to the Chief's question, you said there are no, you cannot go anyplace to find legislative duties.
Today, there is no law that defines the legislative duty. That is correct. That is the state of Wisconsin law today.
Then it seems to me it follows that from your analysis that as of today, since you cannot go anyplace to find a definition of duty, that legislator can be prosecuted under 946.12, which requires a definition of duty. No one can be prosecuted as the law exists today.
I could make that argument. I'm not making that argument, however.
It seems to me that's the necessary extension of your argument. I mean, I can't see any logical extension other than that. Am I right or wrong?
You're always right, but let me explain why I differ with that point of view. And I differ with that point of view because I concede, as did Mr. Olson, that it is inherent for a legislator to show up to vote on issues of state legislation. I'm not sure they have to show up for committee meetings. I'm not sure they have to be in their office at certain times. And I think absence of attendance in the office certainly couldn't give rise to criminal misconduct. But I do think that if you look at the Tronca court's view of that particular statute, and I think what Justice Heffernan said in that case was, don't bother us with this argument about this isn't illegal. It's like a malum in se, malum prohibitum. There are some things that are just evil in themselves, and I think you can prosecute under this statute for that. I don't think that you can say that if you trespass over the line of what the Court of Appeals seems to be able to find, legitimate legislative activity and then political activity, that you put yourself in harm's way to go to prison. That's what I'm saying, and that's in this case. So that's my position in response to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Gimbel. Mr. Meyer, you're representing Scott Jensen.
May it please the Court, fellow counsel, I'm Steve Meyer. I represent the appellant, Scott Jensen. Being the fourth lawyer to speak puts me in a somewhat different position from my fellow counsel on that. A lot of the areas have been covered. And I'm going to try to jump around a little bit and address questions that have been raised by the Court. The first is the Ornstein decision in the Court of Last Resort. That's the case we cited in our initial brief. And the cite for the Court of Last Resort in Ornstein is contained in pages 33 and 34 of our initial brief. And what the Assistant Attorney General did not tell you and did not quote from that decision is the following language from that court. To wit, this prosecution rests on a single prosecutorial premise that political campaign activities were not a proper duty of a legislative staff member. The prosecution also urged that a senator's power to assign duties to legislative assistants should be limited to governmental activities and should not include purely political ones. And the Court of Last Resort in New York disagreed with that premise proffered by the prosecution, and it is identical to the premise that's proffered here this morning. As a matter of fact, the Court went on to say, the highest court, the Court of Last Resort, although this distinction may be relevant to other state employees, the line between political and governmental activities is not so easily drawn in cases dealing with legislators and their assistants. Political activities, as opposed to governmental activities, quote, are considered an inherent part of the job of an elected representative and thus perfectly legitimate acts for a legislator or assistant to perform, end quote.
Well, but didn't they also say that there's no law expressly or interpreted by the courts that declared any of the acts criminal?
And that's exactly the situation we have here.
You have some criminal statutes on misdemeanor counts.
We do have criminal statutes on misdemeanor counts. But recall,
not in the New York case, is that
which
right?
Are not in the New York case. But recall that the state has conceded no less than five times, three times in the Court of Appeals, twice before this court, that there is no statute, express or otherwise, that says what they want it to say. In other words, that using state resources for campaign purposes is prohibited. They have conceded that five times.
Why do you think that?
Because there isn't one.
What about the statutes that say you can't use state property for campaign contributions, to solicit funds?
Those are all individual acts. So charge us with that if they apply.
Well, but look, counsel, in the criminal statutes, there are just dozens of criminal statutes, and they're overlapping. and sometimes even have a statute that says exactly the same thing and is a misdemeanor and is a felony, and you have prosecutorial choice. And you have statutes that are misdemeanors, but then you got another statute that says if you do it more than X number of times in X number, Y number of years, you're all of a sudden a felony, right?
Right.
And you got three strikes, and you're out.
Exactly.
And the legislature can do that.
That's right. Right.
So why can't you argue that in this particular situation, you got these base statutes that say, thou shalt not. They're prohibitory. I recognize that. And then it says, well, if you use your discretion and you violate one of these statutes on company time, you've been upped.
Well, we haven't been charged with that, Your Honor. They have picked and chosen from four or five different locations. I mean, let's look at the history of this case. Number one, what happened when they filed the complaint? What did they define the duties of in the criminal complaint? They said, oh, it's emails and a clerk's report. And we said, well, wait a minute. How can that define our duties? Oh, maybe counsel's got something there. So then the second time, what did they say? The briefing at the trial court level, well, we're going to add chapters 11, 12, and 19 now. And they held to that position until the Court of Appeals briefing, and then they said, well, there's also this common law fiduciary duty. So it has morphed from day one. They don't know what standards to follow. I mean, really the crux of this is, what is the universe? There's a huge universe of duties for a legislator. And we all walk around with our own concept of what a legislator's duty should be. My viewpoint of my legislator, what he or she shouldn't do, they have their concept. The question is, which ones, the violations of which duties, allow this charge to be brought, this particular charge to be brought? And what's happened here is that the district attorney for Dane County has delegated to himself a basic social policy issue. I'll pick and choose what duties without any statutory direction. I'm going to take a little bit from the emails. I'm going to take a little bit from Chapter 11. I'm going to take some from employee manual. That's what the problem is. What are the standards next time? What about the next case? The next assistant district attorney who's sitting there going, well, let's see, they picked that group. What collage am I going to come up with? And what selection of duties? He said, well, the DA can pick and choose whatever he wants. I mean, I understand what the court's saying here. There's a question of importation of Chapter 11 and 19 into this. And I just want you to think about this concept. We have a comprehensive scheme in Chapter 11 for dealing with campaign finance. I mean, that Chapter 11 would say, okay, here's our statute on campaign finance. And in Chapter 11, there are statutes that have no penalties, such as 11.001 sub 2. We're trying to equalize the playing field statute. There are statutes, 11.36, that have a forfeiture as a penalty. And then there are other statutes that have the misdemeanor consequences. And what the state is saying is that, and if you look at their briefs, they keep talking about that policy one. That one doesn't even have any penalties in Chapter 11. But they're saying, hey, for incumbent public officers, if they violate that policy statute, that's going to be a felony. How much that? That's irrational. That is absolutely irrational. The comprehensive scheme for dealing with the campaign finance has said, look at this one's just a policy statement. There's no penalty for violating it. But yet, according to their theory, hey, guess what? You get to go to Dodge Correctional.
Counsel, I need help with this.
Okay.
Let's say I was involved in a campaign, hypothetically speaking. And
depends on which county.
Okay.
Is it county headquarters in Dean, or is it in...
I'm sorry.
That's okay. And not so hypothetically speaking, let's say I have a very talented law clerk. And so, boy, it would be easy for me, as a justice of the Supreme Court, I mean, I like to keep my life easy and simple as possible. I'd like to be able to say to my law clerk, hey, can you run a database of all my campaign contributions, and can you make a few phone calls? I mean, you've got a nice line there. I've got my photocopier in my office. I have the printer. I mean, that would make life easy for me. But I feel, now, I'm jettisoning the words here on purpose. I feel that I have a duty to not use my law clerk to run my political campaign. Now, I may not find that in the Code of Judicial Conduct. I may not find that in a state statute that says justices running for the Supreme Court may not use their law clerks to run their political campaign while in the law clerk's office. I mean, there's no statute that says that. But I think I have a duty to refrain from that. So can you respond to what I...
Well,
to me it's obvious, but it may not be prosecutable or...
Right. I mean, and I think there is, first of all, the very threshold question. The judiciary is a different branch than the legislative.
Okay.
I mean, and that really is important here, because everything they do is political.
Well,
I mean, it is the branch of government where we bring different duties into play, and then they flush it out. And that's a difference.
I grant you that. Let's make it really narrow. And that is, let's say a legislator was having someone work on their campaign. You know, that would be consistent because legislators do political things that are different from what a judge does or a justice does. But if you put it in the context of a campaign for re-election of either a legislator, so let's keep it narrow. So why am I wrong?
Number one, that's what happens. Every staffer, everything they do is geared towards that. And I can't define for you, because there are no guideposts for me anywhere as to when that staffer's in the office, is that a legislative or is that a campaign? You know, when the constituent comes in and says, you know, Charlie, I voted for you. You know, you talked about health care reform. Where's health care reform? And Charlie says, gee, you know, we aren't the majority party. Or my caucus doesn't want to go for it. And the guy says, well, what can I do to help? And awesome, bingo. Is that a campaign? Is that legislative? I can't.
And I understand that. So I want to make it, I just want to make it starker. Hi, this is John Smith. I'm a clerk for Justice Bradley, and I'm wondering if you can help us out here. You know, we're running for re-election, and we're trying to get friends of Bradley together. I know 1,000 each. Can we count on you? Now that, to me, that's campaign. That doesn't get into this world of ideas. And I put that same hypothetical to a legislator, not talk about the world of ideas.
Okay. It may feel wrong, but it's not a violation of the statute.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Morgan. Mr. Meyer, I'm sorry. Steve Morgan, representing Sherry Schultz.
May it please the Court. I am Steve Morgan. I represent Sherry Schultz, who is the only non-legislative person involved in these criminal charges. She was an employee. I want to focus on an issue that nobody else has focused on. I obviously adopt the other issues and comments that they've made. The state is claiming that Chapter 11, as well as 1219, as well as the 1978 Ethics Code, it gives the duties here. But Chapter 11, until section was repealed in 2003, Chapter 11 included Section 11.265. 11.265 established legislative campaign committees. And these LCCs were legal. The LCCs for the LCC for the assembly was the RACC, the Republican, for the Republican side was the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee. In the law, in the statute, and in the Katzmann case, which we have cited on one of our reply briefs, it is very clear that legally speaking, these LCCs could both raise money, receive the money, and then pay it out to the campaign and to individual legislators who were running or individual candidates who were not yet legislators. So we have now in the statute, I'm sorry.
And state time paid by the state?
It does not say.
Yeah, but you can have campaign committees that are set forth in the statute too that are authorized, legalized, told how to operate, but doesn't say whether they do it on state time.
And that becomes the vagueness, Your Honor. If it is legal for Sherry Schultz, as it is alleged in the complaint, there's over 20 references in the complaint to Sherry Schultz engaging in RACC activities, one of which was she was listed on an organizational chart as the fundraising coordinator. Another was she taught fundraising and campaign law to the other RACC people. Other times she attended RACC meetings and she spoke about money raised and money paid out. Now, if it is legal for her to engage in that activity, where is the precision that is required in a criminal charge? She is legally acting on behalf of her bosses to raise money and then to find where it should go. If there is to be a vagueness here, and there is, it is in that problem. You cannot have a statute, 11.265, which prescribes a duty for an employee, followed by a statute that says, no, you can't do that. She is legally engaging in activity. And if it's on state time, by the way, the assembly had a 37.5-hour time frame for a month or for a week of work. If in that 37.5 hours she does work on RACC work, I don't see a statute that says she couldn't do that. I also don't see a statute that says if she does it after her 37.5 hours that it is fine. It is assumed that
Mr. Morgan,
it is fine.
Is your attack on the statute one strictly of vagueness? You're claiming that it's vague as applied to your client, or are you claiming a violation of due process, a lack of fair notice? What exactly are you claiming? I heard you use vagueness just a minute ago.
It is the vagueness primarily that is involved, and I have trouble, as Mr. Gimmel does, of trying to put a bright line between fair notice and due process in these. I'm positive they are involved, but on the other hand, it is vagueness. We do not know, in sitting down with a client, as Mr. Gimbel went through, what it is that would be in violation. The state has pulled out the 1978 ethics opinion. Interesting. In 1978, 11.265 wasn't on the books. It didn't come on the books until the year 1980. Well, obviously, the ethics board, when issuing its opinion, didn't have to find a difference between 11.265 and the other statutes and the other issues that they were facing. But I suggest that they should have subsequently, if the state's going to be able to use an ethics opinion and say, you violated that. Now you go to jail. Even though the jail statute, 946.12, doesn't say so, I think there has to be notice in 946.12. If there isn't notice there, then so what? The state can't use that statute. But can they use another statute? Of course. Why do they get to stuff into one statute of their choice these facts and this attempt to prosecute? That's not appropriate. They could choose other statutes they didn't. They have chosen a statute for which the law, simply for the facts involved here, it doesn't work. If it would have worked with misdemeanors, they should have charged them. But you can't just go as a prosecutor, and I was a prosecutor for 15 years, you can't just pick a statute out of thin air and say, it's mine, it's here, and I'm going after the violation.
What was the discretionary duty that she was engaged in?
I've had trouble with that all along, and I was happy to hear the court say that the duty is prohibitory. I do not know how you exercise a discretionary power in a manner inconsistent with a prohibition.
Well, did she have the power to decide what she was going to do during the week?
During the week, I'm sure she did, yes. But is that a power? A discretionary power is the wording of the statute. It is discretion, certainly, but is it a power?
Did she have the power to assign others in the office as to what they should do?
As a legislative aide, there are no duties to describe that. Did she probably ask other people to do so? And I think that the complaint alleges that. Yes, I think the complaint says
that. Were there other people on that committee?
I'm sorry?
Were there other people on that committee?
Absolutely. And the people...
Aid employees by the state?
Absolutely.
And she...
There's probably 10 or 15 listed in the complaint, including her two bosses who ran the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee, who are not charged, and who exercise, according to the complaint, hundreds of hours working for the RACC, and they are not charged. That's the vagueness, that's the lack of notice, Justice Crooks. I can't find it for this employee. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Oswald?
May it please the Court. As this Court is now aware, I am Assistant Attorney General Barbara Oswald, and I represent the State of Wisconsin, the respondent in this case. Once again, the State asks this Court to hold that the defendants, Scott Jensen, Stephen Foti, and Sherry Schultz, can properly be prosecuted under 946.12, subsection 3, for the alleged use of state employees and other state resources for the personal benefit of individual candidates and campaign organizations. Specifically, the State asks the Court to hold the following. First, that the defendants failed to prove that the statute is unconstitutionally vague as applied. Second, that the defendant's overbreadth claim has already been decided to the contrary by this Court in Tronca, and even if it hadn't been, the First Amendment is not implicated here. And finally, that prosecution for the alleged conduct here does not violate the separation of powers. One issue that has not come up yet with respect to vagueness or notice is the issue of whether or not the defendants have standing to raise notice and vagueness. The complaint is replete with allegations that the defendants were in fact aware of the illegality of their conduct. Jensen specifically told somebody in 1997 that it was illegal to do campaign work on state time or with state resources. He himself said that the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee, that business of that committee must be done off state time and that it should be separate from the Assembly Republican Caucus. He denied using his staff that his staff used state equipment for campaign work. The director of the Assembly Republican Caucus, Jason Cradwell, twice went to Jensen and Foti and asked them to remove Sherry Schultz from the caucus offices so that she would not be doing fundraising on state time. Schultz herself indicated she could go to jail for what she'd done. Foti was told by a staff person there was no way Schultz could do campaign activity from his office. And one of the witnesses at the preliminary hearing testified that she knew very well that what she was doing was illegal and that, in fact, when people were copying campaign checks in Jensen's office, there was sort of a lookout system. People would be on the alert to see if anyone was coming so that they could alert the person doing the copying. So it's very clear from the facts of the complaint that the defendants were on notice and, in fact, were aware of the illegality of their actions. They take issue with respect to the fact that the statute does not define duties. And I'm hearing very conflicting arguments here. One is that you cannot look, that it has to be defined by statute, that you cannot look to a criminal statute to define it. You can't look to a forfeiture statute to define it. There are some inherent duties that you can look to, even though you have to look to a statute. And you can't look to policy statements by the legislature setting forth specifically in the statutes duties, such as all of Chapter 11 is intended to preclude public officials from using the state resources to advantage an incumbent over a non-incumbent who doesn't have access to those resources. So I find these vagueness and fair notice arguments to be extremely inconsistent. And I think this Court just needs to apply the standards that exist out there, the legal standards. A statute is not required to itemize with particularity every possible kind of conduct which would violate the statute. As this Court has recognized, few words possess the precision of mathematical symbols.
Ms. Oswald, let me, since you're talking about duties and about the requirement of violation of duties in 946.12.3, I shared with my colleagues that several nights ago, I woke up during the middle of the night with what I now consider a nightmare. And basically, I started thinking about your position, the state's position, and how that would apply to other branches of government. And the first one that came to mind, of course, was the judicial branch of government. And when I got back to my chambers, I started looking at statutory sections. We have 757.025, which talks about the judge filing an affidavit so that he or she can get their salary, indicating their current in regard to deciding cases. That statute, I think, some question of constitutionality, but there's also a Supreme Court rule, 70.36, that directs itself to the same thing, requires the affidavit basically saying you're current in regard to your work. There's provisions in the Supreme Court rules that talk about judge shall perform the duties of judicial office impartially and diligently, and spells out a whole list of duties required of judges. There's provisions in regard to disqualification. And the fact that the statute says that you're supposed to give a reason when you disqualify yourself. There's a Supreme Court rule that's contrary. But these are all duties set forth in regard to judges. Now, let's assume that I was not diligent in getting out my opinions when I was on the trial bench, and that I was still desirous of getting my salary, even though I was 6 or 8 or 9 months behind in getting out my opinions. Could I not have been charged with violation of 946.12.3?
If you did so, if you exercised the discretionary power of your office
and didn't get my work done,
and with the intent to gain a dishonest advantage, yes, you could potentially be charged with misconduct.
My salary being that advantage, right?
Correct. Okay. Potentially.
There's going to the other branches of government, too. I had very much the same kind of question. 165.015 has the duties of the Attorney General and sets forth a number of duties like protecting trust funds, keeping statements of fees, reporting to the legislature. Could the same thing happen to the Attorney General?
Yes, I think it can happen to any public official who uses their office corruptly in that they exercise a discretionary power with the intent to gain a dishonest advantage.
Would there not be a notice, a due process issue?
The notice is that if you engage in discretionary behavior, discretionary powers in your official capacity, and it's inconsistent with the duties of the office, and you do so with the dishonest advantage, you may be prosecuted for misconduct in public office. I don't see the vagueness or the notice problem there. I use the example of me deliberately failing to file a criminal complaint in order to benefit a friend or a family member. There is no specific statutory duty which sets, or no specific statute which sets that out, but yet it is very clear that such a thing would be a complete misuse of my office and my employment.
There's no statute that defines your duties as assistant AG at all.
Correct. Correct. Other than to say we have the powers available to assistant district attorneys.
So does that mean that the AG is the one that's exposed to this, but the assistant AGs are not?
No, I do believe there is a statute that that gives us the same authorities as the Attorney General. I'm not completely clear on that. not remembering the nature of the statutes that lay out the duties of the Department of Justice, but there is a statute that, or a chapter. But I do think that there are, in fact, inherent things, duties, that it's very clear. This case
An employee handbook?
An employee handbook, yes. Yes, it could be, if you violate a work rule, it could be the basis for a misconduct charge if you exercise your discretionary power with the intent to gain a dishonest advantage. We're not talking about somebody who just fails to comply with a work rule or something like that. I mean, there are specific elements in the public misconduct statute that have to be met, and that is what makes it, those elements taken together are what provide the notice.
Counselor, but if I buy your argument, then we're back to common law crimes. Because you don't have the legislature, you have a committee of the legislature, one part of the legislature that put together this assembly handbook, but we don't have common law crimes in Wisconsin.
We don't have common law crimes, and we're not talking about a common law crime. We have a statutory crime, 946.12 subsection 3, and there's nothing wrong with the court looking at the common law to define the duties, and that's the Schwartz case, where they had looked at the master-servant relationship to define the duties of that particular employee. And I would note that the defendants try to argue that that particular employee's duties were set forth in statute. That's not the case at all. That person was an accounts receivable clerk. The statute that they cite to is the duties of the treasurer for the school district or whatever body is at issue there. So that person's duties were not set forth in statute. And the court looked to common law. So we're not talking about creating a common law crime. We're talking about a statutory crime, but we can look to the common law. As the Judiciary Committee noted with respect to subsection 1, you can look to the common law in other places to decipher the extent of the duties. I think it's important what Justice Bradley was getting at, which is if there is no duty for legislators defined in statute, then under the defendant's arguments, we can never charge them with misconduct in public office, and we can never charge most public officials and most public employees with misconduct in public office.
Well, maybe not for the particular crime we're talking about here, which certainly could have been charged under Chapter 11 or under Chapter 19, correct? But bribery, which already is a felony, my major concern is, you know, if the legislators were aware of Chapter 11, particularly 11.36 bothers me, and they chose to contravene it anyway, they would have known that they were violating a criminal statute in regard to the punishment that could be asserted against them. But I worry that they would have had notice that that conduct would fall within the prescription of a felony statute. Though if they accepted bribes, which in itself is a felony, then to me it seems the punishments are not that different. But there's such a difference between a misdemeanor and a felony.
There is a difference between a misdemeanor and a felony, and whether or not a statute is vague does not depend on whether or not somebody knew about the penalty section. All that needs to be, the question is not whether the defendants knew they could be prosecuted or sent to prison for this. The question is whether a reasonable person could look at 946.12, subsection 3, and a person who's bent on obeying the law, unlike the defendants in this case, whether or not they could discern that their conduct neared the region of prescribed
conduct. But that's vagueness. What about due process?
Well, I think they're all, I don't know where the lines are drawn. I certainly have not been practicing law nearly as long as Mr. Gimble, and if he doesn't know and can't tell you, then I certainly can't either. But I think that the analysis is very similar there. I think Justice Bradley was right on when she said, if I hire a law clerk to do my campaign activity, or if I hire a law clerk to go run my Mary Kay Cosmetics business or my insurance business or anything else, we know that it's wrong.
Right.
It's inherently wrong. It's evil per se, as Mr. Gimble indicated. And there's nothing different in this case than somebody using a law clerk, hiring a law clerk, hiring a legislative staffer to do personal business for them. The entire purpose of Sherry Schultz's hiring was for her to do campaign fundraising work. And there may be instances where legislative and political activities mix, but that is not this case. That is not this case. These are pure campaign activities, as the Court of Appeals properly found. So
it still doesn't address my concern about the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor. And the notice problems when someone reads the statute and says, oh, yeah, oops, I violated 1136, or even without the oops, I intentionally did this.
Again, there are ways to violate some of the misdemeanor statutes which do not involve, for instance, a dishonest advantage. Some of them do, but some of them don't. So, for example, anyone could violate 11.36 subsection 1, and I want to get back to that point because I want to address the Schmidt case. But anyone can violate that statute, but if you do so by abusing your public position, then it's a felony, and that's what we have here.
So what you're telling me is that if you're a legislator, you're not going to get charged under 11.61. But if you're not a public official and you do the same thing, you will be charged under that section, yet you rely on that section for the duty for the legislator.
I think that they could be charged under either one. And
or both,
and the prosecutor has the ability to exercise discretion in that matter, and I don't believe that violates due process or fair notice or anything like that.
Okay, now you want to make a comment about Schultz, and I want you to finish that.
Okay, I want to make a comment about Schmidt because I think that holding is being misinterpreted. There is some suggestion that what Schmidt stood for was the proposition that a public official cannot be prosecuted for misconduct in public office when they violate a general statute as opposed to a specific statute specific to that particular official or employee. And that is not at all what the Court of Appeals said in that case. The problem in that case was not that the individual violated a general statute. The problem was that that individual violated a general statute without any connection to her public employment or her position as a prison guard. And I happen to disagree with the Court of Appeals on their conclusion that she didn't use her public position in gaining access to that prisoner. But nonetheless, the bottom line is they indicated specifically in that case that if she had issued threats or made promises in order to gain consent from that individual to have sex with that individual, then it could have been prosecuted under 946.12. And so the Court of Appeals there was not holding that you cannot use a general statute as a basis for duties, a violation of duties with respect to misconduct in public office. What they were holding there was you actually have to engage in the behavior as in your capacity, in your official capacity, which was what the whole focus was. And I would ask this Court to specifically address that issue in its decision because I think that the statute, that case law is being misinterpreted and misapplied.
Thank you. Is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision you think, if the Court thought it was a good decision, should be changed? Anything that bothers you about that decision?
The only thing, it doesn't bother me necessarily, they chose to go to the constitutional issue of vagueness without, they put standing in a footnote, even though they found clearly that the defendants in this case had adequate notice that what they were doing was illegal. It's my understanding that courts generally try to refrain from going to those constitutional issues if there are other grounds by which they can decide the case. That was the only point the only point where I would differ from them. I would have left it at that, but since this Court will be addressing that in both cases, I don't disagree with their analysis at all. And I also believe that they could have gone a lot farther in looking at all the variety of sources that that exist out there. There's just no way that anyone can reasonably argue that they didn't know that what they were doing was wrong or that this was somehow okay. I believe one of the attorneys said that a legislator making phone calls from his office to solicit campaign contributions was okay, and that's just not the case.
I don't know if he said it was okay. He said, we're talking about the same thing, it may be wrong, but the question is whether it can be charged under this statute. That's what I heard the response to be.
And then maybe I misunderstood what he was arguing. I want to address briefly the issue of overbreath, because that has not been discussed at length yet. As this Court knows, overbreath is a facial challenge, and this Court has already decided that contrary to the defendant's position in
Trump. I should have asked the defendants, and I'll ask Mr. Gimbel, there's a debate in the brief as to whether this is a facial or as-applied challenge. How do you view it?
Well, if they're calling it overbreath, it's a facial challenge. If it's an as-applied challenge, then the only thing this Court can look at are the facts of the case. They cannot engage in hypothetical speculation. As this Court knows, overbreath is a strong medicine to be used as last resort, and the Court has said that the overbreath must not only be real but substantial as well. And again, there's some dispute about the burden of proof in this case. It is the duty of the defendants to show that the First Amendment is implicated here, and they just failed to do that. This statute, 946.12, subsection 3, does not regulate speech. It regulates conduct, and therefore it's not susceptible to a First Amendment claim. That's the State versus Robbins decision. This Court in that case said it's not an abridgment of freedom of speech to make a course of conduct illegal merely because the conduct was in part initiated, evidenced, or carried out by means of language, either spoken, written, or printed. There is case law which addresses related issues with respect to chapter prohibitions in Chapter 11, and the Court of Appeals in Crawford versus Wittow, W-H-I-T-T-O-W, said that the section at issue, which limited the amount of mailings a legislator could do with state resources, does not impinge upon the office holders using their own or donated funds for political purposes. It only impinges upon the use of state funds. So what we're talking about here are regulations and restrictions on the use of state property to engage in personal, private campaign use. I just wanted to go back to something that the defendants raised in their argument, if I can find it.
Ms. Oswald, while you're doing that, I've been thinking about something that is raised in defendant's argument. I can't remember which brief or which defendant, but there seemed to be a tying together, at least to me, of the decision of the Court of Appeals in State versus Decker with a decision that we made back about 5 years ago in Elections Board versus WMC. And the relationship, as I understood it, was that in Decker, the Court was saying that you can't bootstrap a departmental regulation, something similar to a Senate rule or an Assembly rule, into a felony of misconduct in public office. In Elections Board versus WMC, we looked at some U.S. Supreme Court cases, and we looked at the idea that due process did not allow for retroactive interpretation. And as I understand the argument, they're claiming that that's what you're doing here, that there is really retroactive interpretation occurring by cobbling together, if you will, all of these sections and saying that amounts to misconduct in public office. How do you respond to that?
I don't think that... Let me back up. The fact that this case is before this Court and the statute has to be interpreted by this Court does not mean that we're engaging in retroactive judicial interpretation or legislative interpretation or anything like that, retroactive rulemaking. If that were the case, then any time this Court engaged in statutory interpretation, anyone who was charged prior to that would be off the hook.
But doesn't that seem to tie into this idea of due process and fair notice? That if as Ornstein said, you've got to have a law expressly on point or a court interpretation prohibiting the activity, doesn't that tie into this idea of fair notice? The idea that due process is offended where what's happening now is we're being asked in regard to these defendants to interpret 946.12.3 to cover all of this type of activity.
I may not be understanding the Court's question. I'll try to address it.
Maybe that's why I'm struggling with it.
I suggest that since Decker was raised, you attempt at pages 34 to 35 of your brief to reconcile.
Correct.
Decker. And if that's the Justice's question, I would suggest you might want to try and reconcile, if you can, Decker and Elections Board. Is that?
Yes.
I think that's what the Justice's goal is.
First of all, Decker did not involve the subsection that we're talking about here.
About what?
It not involved
one.
Correct, which discusses a mandatory duty. And the court found that a departmental rule to provide first aid was discretionary rather than mandatory, so the person could not be charged under that subsection. In contrast, obviously, this subsection does not require that the duty be mandatory, nor does it require that it be set forth by law. And the State pointed out in its brief that the language of subsection 3 is very different from some of the other subsections in the misconduct statute. Subsections 1, 2, and 5 all use the term, use the word law, lawful duty, duty imposed by law, or similar things. That language is not present in subsection 3. That doesn't mean that you can't look at law, such as the common law or these other statutes, but it isn't required. And the Decker decision just did not stand for the proposition that the defendants are trying to make it stand for, which is you can never look at a work rule as a basis for prosecution. And so there's no retroactive rulemaking by creating a new definition of anything. We're not creating a new definition of duty. We're not creating a new definition of anything. So there's no retroactive rulemaking going on here. And the defendant's arguments assumes that the prosecution is based solely on violation of a work rule, which we've already talked about, is not present here. The work rule happens to be based upon very specific statutes set forth in the statute books. And so the argument that Decker somehow provided them notice that they couldn't be prosecuted for violation of a work rule just doesn't apply, because that is not the sole basis of prosecution in this case.
A different statute, different kind of rule within for the employee or the officer.
Correct. Correct.
Not saying, oh, well, for the cops then, I mean, if I understand your argument, for the cops then it was a work rule, but for the legislators now, they're saying it's something else.
Right.
And that's the retroactivity issue, as I understand the argument on the other side.
Have I answered it?
I think
there's part of your question that I haven't addressed yet.
Well, I understood that this was all tied, the Decker and Elections Board was all tied in with Ornstein, too, and with the requirement that seems to be in Ornstein that you know, you've got to have a law expressly prohibiting the activity, or you've got to have a court interpretation doing so. And I'm just wondering if you, obviously you don't agree that these are all tied together, but as I understand the argument on the other side, they're saying they are indeed. And I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
And I'm not understanding how those pieces fit together. I didn't understand that from the briefs. But I can say that if there is a requirement under any of those cases or any of those legal propositions that duties have to be defined in statutes, then we have that present in this case, because there are specific statutes that prohibit the conduct that was engaged in here.
Or by court interpretation.
Or by court interpretation. And so I don't see the problem that those principles or those cases raise. But maybe I'm not understanding the court's question.
No, I think you understood the question, and you made a valiant effort to answer it. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure I like that response to that. I want to address briefly, with the remaining time I have, the issue of justiciability in this case. The rule at issue here is no different than the rule addressed in the rule that existed in the Senate in the Koala case. They're almost identical in terms of language. And what that says is you cannot use state employees on state time, and you cannot use state resources for the purposes of political political activity. And political activity has been equated or used interchangeably with campaign activity. For long before the campaign finance laws ever came into existence, the state cited some case law in its brief as to some cases that existed in the 1930s, and I think there might even be some before that. There can be no doubt that campaign activity, as alleged here, is political activity, as that is under any reasonable interpretation of that word. And the court can be very confident that the allegations here fall within the prohibition that the legislature sets forth in its employee handbook and in the emails and other sources that exist out there. There's been some discussion about how everything a legislator does is political, all that sort of thing, how the lines blur. We've already talked about the fact that the allegations in this case are pure campaign activities. The legislature itself obviously recognizes a distinction between political campaign activity and legislative activity because they adopted a rule which says you cannot engage in political activity on state time or with state resources. So it cannot be a duty of a legislature, and it cannot be part of everything a legislature does if the legislature itself says you can't do it. And it is no stretch of any interpretation of the rule to say that the allegations here, the conduct engaged in here, clearly fits within the prohibition of that rule and within the prohibitions of Chapter 11, Chapter 12, and Chapter 19. There is no ambiguity, so there is no separation of powers problem. There is no justiciability problem. Unless the court has further questions, I'm just going to wrap up at this point. Again, we are just asking this court to hold that the statute is not unconstitutionally vague or overbroad and that the prosecution of the charged conduct does not violate the separation of powers doctrine. And we ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Oswald. Gimbel.
Thank you very much.
Facial or as applied?
It's as applied. And that's what I was going to say right off the bat. We are not making a facial attack. We are not challenging the ruling in Tronca. We're not asking you to overrule Tronca. We're asking you to look at Tronca from with a different set of glasses on. Look at it from the set of glasses where you're talking about essentially a malum prohibitum type of an offense as against a malum in se. And I don't believe that with any view of the Court of Appeals decision that as Mr. as Ms. Oswald said, that the behavior here is evil behavior. It is prohibited behavior as outlined in chapters 11, 12, and 19, and as the Chief recognized when and I'm not going to put words in the Chief's mouth, corrected a statement that these were an outline specifying duties. They were an outline of specific prohibitions, and we accept that. I think what Ms. Oswald said in her argument was that to our question about assessing the issues of notice and vagueness, that you have to look at it through the eyes of a reasonable person. Well, I'd like to quote a reasonable person, and that person is Judge Moser, who in his decision on these motions said, and you'll find this quote on page 12 of our brief, "I frankly think some of the activities, as one of the witnesses said, blur," Judge Moser's word, not an advocate's word, "between legitimate activity and purely campaign activity. When you talk about the duties of legislation, I think they are hard to define." Now, I think Judge Moser is a reasonable person, even though we seek to reverse his decision. He had trouble with the definition, and I think he fell into the trap, if you will, the same trap that I think the Court of Appeals fell into when it rendered its decision here, trying to maintain that we as courts who set standards of behavior for the state of Wisconsin are not going to say that it's okay to run political campaigns out of your elected office. And as I said in my very first remarks to you here this afternoon, or this morning, it started out as this morning, it's now afternoon, that's not the goal here. The end game here is not to get this court to license the operation of political campaigns out of state offices. What the end game is to exercise your responsibility to give notice that if the behavior that is outlined in this complaint is or should be criminal, then that should be an expression of the legislation that the legislative branch of government addresses. And they can take up the facts of this case and go back and create an understandable, notice-giving set of standards by which our clients and those who follow them in their offices will be able to understand before they engage in behavior and then fall through the trap door of leading them to the reception center at the correction center. I do think that the question that Justice Bradley raised deserves some kind of an answer, and that was about her feelings. And I think it falls into place with our statement about notice is not what a thoughtful, intelligent judge would view to be proper behavior. The question is a person who is entitled to know when he or she enters into the framework of a day's activities that if I go this way, I am putting myself in harm's way to be prosecuted for criminal misbehavior. And Section 946.12, subsection 3, doesn't do that. It doesn't do that. And that's what we're asking you to find specifically with respect to the absence of a legislative expression of what the duties are that were supposed to have been violated in this matter. And I think each and every one of you have come at this long morning's worth of discussions on these very important cases, recognizing that there are statements of duties for a whole garden variety of public offices, but there ain't none for legislators. And the point is that if they're not there for legislators, then this court or the Court of Appeals or Judge Moser should not be in a position to step into the place of the legislative branch of government and create a statement as to what the duties are. And that's exactly what the state has asked Judge Moser to do, and it asked the Court of Appeals to do, and it's asking you to do here today, and we're asking you not to be tempted. Don't go there. Do create a brighter line. Send this subject matter back to the legislature where it belongs for a precise and appropriate statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gimbel. I want to thank all the lawyers this morning, Mr. Olson and Mr. Gimbel, Meyer, Morgan, and Ms. Oswald for excellent arguments on very difficult legal issues. That closes our hearing on 03-0106-CR, State versus Jensen. I'd like to welcome our new students from Royal High School and say that they're welcome to come down to the courtroom on the second floor east wing, and they will meet with Justice Prosser in just a few moments. The court will reconvene for oral argument at 1:30.